Boys, he said mildly, you quarrel all the time.
Johnny, in angry mouthfuls, told him what he thought about Dove and the charcoal and threw in a cutting remark about Dusty. The old master said, Dove, I want to speak to Johnny alone. And then, Johnny, I don't want you to be always riding them boys so hard. Dove tries, but he's stupid.
Ain't his fault, is it? If God had wanted him to be bright, he would have made him that way. We're all poor worms. You're getting above yourself, like I tried to point out to you. God is going to send you a dire punishment for your pride.
Yes, sir. One trouble with you is you haven't been up against any boys as good as yourself, or better, maybe. Because you're the best young one in this shop, or on Hancock's Wharf, you think you're the best one in the world.
Johnny was so anxious to be on with the work, tediously delayed by Dove's tricks, he hardly listened.
And boy, don't you go get all fretted up over what's after all nothing but an order for silver. It's sinful to let yourself go so over mundane things. Now I want you to set quietly and memorize them verses I had you read about pride. Work's over for the day.
What?
Yep. It always was the old-fashioned way to start Lord's Day at sunset on Saturday, and I've decided to reestablish the habit in my house.
Mr. Lapham, we've got to work this evening. We promised Mr. Hancock.
I doubt God cares even a little bit whether Mr. Hancock has any silver. It's better to break faith with him, isn't it, than with the Lord?
Johnny was tired. His head was ringing. His hands shook a little. He walked out of the shop, slamming the door after him, and stormed into the kitchen. He knew Mrs. Lapham did not take much stock in her father-in-law's pious ways. She and all four girls were in the kitchen. Madge was frying cornmeal, Dorcas wringing out a cheesecloth. Scylla was setting the table, and Azana playing with the cat. Mrs. Lapham looked at him.
Boy, have you seen a ghost?
Johnny sat and told his story. He was beyond his customary abusive eloquence. The girls stared at him with piteous open mouths. Mrs. Lapham's jaw set grimly.
Dorcas, shut that door. Don't let your grandpa hear.
Johnny, how many more work hours will you need?
7, maybe. I can get 2 Monday morning.
You shall have them. Sabbath or no Sabbath, that sugar basin is going to be done on time. I'm not letting any old-fashioned fussy notions upset the best order we've had for 10 years. And if Mr. Hancock is pleased, he may come again and again. I can't have my poor fatherless girls starve just to please Grandpa. Listen now to me.
Sunday afternoon, Mr. Lapham was not only going to the second service as usual, but there was going to be a meeting of the deacons, a cold supper afterward, and a prayer service at the pastor's.
That's where you get them 5 hours, Johnny, tomorrow afternoon.
Johnny knew that working on the Sabbath was against the law as well as against all his religious training. He might very well go to the stocks or to hell for it, but when Mrs. Lapham said, "Darest to, Johnny?" he said, "I darest."
Not a word to the old gentleman, mind.
Not a word.
Girls, if you so much as peep.
Oh, no, Ma.
Dove and Dusty were to be bribed into service by the promise of delivering the basin to Mr. Hancock when done. He always gave money to boys who brought things to the house. Mrs. Lapham was breathing hard, but she had the matter well in hand. It was settled.
Izana, she said quietly, you call Grandpa and the boys into supper. Scylla, run down cellar and fetch cold ale.
Her mouth and the folds about it, even her nose and eyes, were like iron.
3. Sunday afternoon, and the work went forward with never a hitch. Even Dove and Dusty were good and obedient, although Dove was half-threatening to tell old Grandpa when he got home. Johnny did not care what his master might say, only, please God, the basin were done and Mr. Hancock come again and again with his rich orders. If Mr. Lapham was angry, he could sell Johnny's time to Paul Revere. The four girls, still dressed in their pretty go-to-meetin' frocks, watched him with fascinated, admiring eyes. Their mother sent them out of doors. Did the smoke from the furnace show from the wharf? From Fish Street?
Did they hear any comments?
Having found for himself the proper willow charcoal, Johnny went quickly ahead with his casting. He set his two wax models in wet sand. The furnace was piping hot. His hands were very sure. He was confident he could do the work, yet inside he was keyed up and jumpy. Mrs. Lapham fussed about him, and he ordered her to do simple things. "Not the draft yet, Mrs. Lapham. Now get to work with the bellows." Once he even told her to look sharp, and she took it with a humble, "Yes, Johnny." "Now fetch me the crucible." She turned to Dove. "Which one does he want, boy?" "I'll get her down." Dove went to the shelves where the crucibles for melting silver were kept. Johnny did not see Dove standing on a stool, reaching far back and carefully taking out a cracked crucible. Dusty saw him and giggled. He knew the crack in it was so small it was hard even to see. It might stand the heat of the furnace, but the chances were that it would not. That was why Mr. Lapham had put it so far back. Both he and Dove thought it would just about serve Johnny Tremaine right, after the insufferable way he had been bossing everybody, if the crucible gave way and the hot silver did spill all over top of the furnace. It would certainly make Johnny look like a fool after all his fussing. Johnny took the cracked crucible in his trusting hands, put in its silver ingots, set it on the top of the furnace. Scylla flew in. "Ma, there's a man looking at a chimney." "How's he dressed?" "Seafaring man." "No seafaring man ever objected to a little Sabbath breaking, but mind if you see any deacons or constables." The work went on. Izana sat with the cat in her lap. "Johnny's going to hell," she said firmly. Johnny himself thought this was possible. He called to Mrs. Lapham to look sharp and put the old silver turnip watch where he could see it. The silver must be run at a certain speed and be allowed to cool for just so long. Mrs. Lapham was so slavishly eager to help him, he almost felt fond of her. He did not notice Dusty and Dove snickering in a corner. Some of the beeswax he had used for his models had been left too near the furnace. It had melted and run all over the floor. Johnny had been taught to clean up as he went along, but today he was in too much of a hurry to bother. "Johnny," cried Mrs. Lapham, "isn't it time to pour? Look, the silver has melted and begun to wink." It was true. He moved forward delicately, his right hand outstretched. The crucible began to settle. Collapse! The silver was running over the top of the furnace like spilled milk. Johnny jumped toward it, his right hand still outstretched. Something happened. He never knew exactly what. His feet went out from under him. His hand came down on top of the furnace. The burn was so terrible he at first felt no pain, but stood stupidly looking at his hand. For 1 second before the metal cooled, the inside of his right hand, from wrist to fingertips, was coated with solid silver. He looked at the back of his hand. It was as always. Then he smelled burned flesh. The room blackened and tipped around him. He heard a roaring in his ears. When he came to, he was stretched out upon the floor. Dorcas was trying to pour brandy down his throat. Mrs. Lapham had plunged the burned hand into a pan full of flour and was yelling at Madge to hurry with her bread poultice. He saw Scylla's face. It was literally green. "Ma," she said, licking her white lips, "shall I run for Dr. Warren?" "No, no. Oh, wait, I gotta think. I don't want any of them doctors to know we was breaking Sabbath day. And we don't need no doctor for just a burn. Scylla, you run down to the wharf and you fetch that old midwife, Gran Hopper. These old women know better than any doctor how to cure things like this. Johnny, how you feel?"
"All right."
"Hurt yet?"
"Not yet."
He knew it would later. 4. Johnny lay in the birth and death room. This was hardly more than a closet with a tiny window off the kitchen used for storage except in times of sickness. His hand had been done up in a linseed poultice. The smell of the linseed was stifling, and now, on the second day, the pain had really begun. His arm throbbed to the shoulder. Gran Hopper was in the kitchen talking to Mrs. Lapham. "Mind you keep that poultice wet. Just leave it wrapped up and wet it now and then with lime water.
There's more luck than anything else in things like this. If it don't come along good, I'll make a charm.
Not many years before, Gran Hopper would have been hanged for a witch. She had the traditional venerable years, the toothless cackle, the mustache. Nor was she above resorting to charms. But she had had vast experience. No doctor in Boston knew more than she about midwifery and children's diseases. So far she had done as well as any of them, except for one thing. The hand had been allowed to draw together, turn in on itself. It was less painful than if it had been held out flat. By the fourth day, ulceration had set in. This was considered nature's way of healing an injury. Gran Hopper gave him laudanum and more laudanum. There followed drowsy days and nights that ran together, a ceaseless roaring in the ears. There was nothing left of him but the pain and the drug. The fever abated, and with it the doses of the drug. Johnny had not once looked at his hand since he had stood before the furnace and seen it lined with silver. Gran Hopper said on the next day she would unwrap it and see, as she cheerfully put it, what was left. Thus far the pain and the drug and the fever had dulled his mind. He had not thought about the future, for of what use to anyone was a cripple-handed silversmith. But that night Gran Hopper's words haunted him. Next day she would see what was left. He was utterly unprepared for the sight of his hand when finally it was unwrapped and lay in the midwife's aproned lap. Mrs. Lapham, Madge, Dorcas, all had crowded into the little birth and death room. Scylla and Izana were in the kitchen, too frightened to go near him.
"My," said Madge, "isn't that funny looking? The top part, Johnny, looks all right, although a little narrow, but Johnny, your thumb and palm have grown together."
This was true. He bent and twisted his fingers. He could not get the thumb to meet the forefinger. Such a hand was completely useless. For the first time, he faced the fact that his hand was crippled.
"Oh, let me see."
Dorcas was leaning over him. She gave her most elegant little screech of horror, just like a great lady who had seen a mouse.
"My," said Mrs. Lapham, "that's worse than anything I had imagined. Now, isn't that a shame? Bright boy like Johnny just ruined, no more good than a horse with sprung knees."
Johnny did not stay to hear more. That morning he had dressed, with Mrs. Lapham's competent help, for the first time. He got up, stood facing them stiffly, his bad hand jammed into his breeches pocket.
"I'm going out," he said thickly.
Scylla and Izana sat close together in a frightened huddle, staring at him, not daring to speak. He said rudely,
"You should have come in, too, and seen the fun."
Scylla gaped at him, tried to say something, but only swallowed. "You two, sitting there looking like a couple of fishes." He slammed the door after him. He had always been bad about slamming doors. In the fresh air, he felt better. He pretended not to hear Mrs. Lapham calling him from a window to come right back. All Fish Street could hear when Mrs. Lapham called. He paid no heed. He walked all over Boston, his hand thrust deep in his breeches pocket. Instinctively, he wanted to tire himself out, which was easy in his weakened condition, so he could not think. When he came back, there was something queer about the silence of the kitchen. No one reproved him because he had disobeyed Mrs. Lapham. He knew they had been talking about him. Scylla, for one of the first times in her life, tried to be polite to him.
"Oh, Johnny," she whispered, "I'm sorrier than I ever was sorry before."
Izana said, "Is it true, like Ma says, you'll only be good for picking rags?" Scylla turned on Izana.
"You're crazy. Johnny isn't going to pick rags.
But, oh, Johnny, it's so awful, and I'm so sorry, and..." Johnny's face was crimson.
"Will you stop talking about it?"
Izana went on. "Madge says it looks awful..."
"If either of you girls," he stormed, "ever mentioned that I've even got a hand, I'll just get on a ship and never come back. I'm not going to have you mucking about with your infernal crybaby."
"Oh, how dreadfuls." so he went to the shop. He saw with anger that Dove was sitting at his bench, daring to use his tools. He had not been in the shop for a month. Of course, it should be expected that Dove would use his bench for a little while, just until he was back at it himself. Mr. Lapham had looked up from his work, blinked gently, shook his head, and sighed. Dusty was making a terrific din in one corner. Johnny stood and watched Dove's clumsy work as long as he could in silence. At last he burst out, "Dove, don't hold your crimping iron like that!" Dove leaned back. His fat, white face grinned up at him with exaggerated innocence. "Thank you, Master Johnny. I know I'm not as good as you are. Won't you please to show me just how I should hold my crimping iron?" Johnny walked out of the shop by the door leading to the wharf. He'd never show anybody again how to hold a crimping iron. If you can't do, you'd best shut up. He started to slam the door, thought better of it. If you can't do, you'd best not slam doors. So he strolled the length of the wharf. There was a big ship in from Jamaica. He idly watched porters rolling barrels of molasses out of its hold. A sailor was trying to sell an old lady a parrot. He saw John Hancock standing in a group of men. The sugar basin had never been delivered. When Mr. Lapham had discovered the evil that had gone on in his absence, and the terrible punishment God had meted out to Johnny Tremaine, he had ordered the whole thing melted down, and he himself had gone over to Mr. Hancock, returned the cream pitcher, and merely said he had found it impossible to make a sugar basin. No explanation. The boy was accustomed to working from 8 to 12, sometimes 14 hours in a day. He had no holidays, no Saturday afternoons. He had often imagined to himself the pleasure it would be just to stroll once down Hancock's wharf as he was strolling now. Nothing to do. His hands in his pockets. Other boys, friends of his, would look up from their work, envy his idleness. Here and there he did see a familiar face. He believed every one of them was talking about his burn, pitying him. There was not a boy on the wharf Johnny did not know. He had made friends with some and enemies of others, and had played or fought with all of them. He saw Saul and Dicer packing salt herrings in a tub. Andy, his leather thimble strapped to his palm, sewing a sail. Tom Drinker, the local bully, coopering a barrel. This was Johnny's world, but now he walked through it, an alien. They knew what had happened. They did not envy Johnny's idleness. He saw one nudge another. They were whispering about him, daring to pity him. Dicer's master, the herring picker, yelled some kind remark to him, but Johnny did not answer. Seemingly in 1 month he had become a stranger, an outcast on Hancock's wharf. He was maimed, and they were whole. At the end of the wharf, under the derrick used for unloading the largest ships, he stripped off his clothes and dove into the water. There was not another working boy in Boston who was out swimming in the middle of the afternoon. Only once or twice in a summer, on days of unendurable heat, teachers dismissed school, masters closed shops, and the boys ran down to the wharves to swim. Sometimes, like Mr. Lapham's boys, they swam secretly, silently, on Sunday afternoons, but usually only after dusk had fallen and the day's work was over. Johnny dove and swam, but it was curious to be alone. He did not like the feeling of being thus cut off from his normal life. Yet one thing gave him great pleasure. Once in the water, his bad hand was as good as the other. Swimming, he could forget it. 5. At first, Mrs. Lapham tended to humor the poor boy. As he preferred the birth and death room to the attic with Dove and Dusty, she had let him stay on. He had never in all his life slept in a bed alone, much less a whole room. He wanted to be alone. There was one trouble with his new quarters. When Mrs. Lapham came down to start breakfast, she always began by getting him up. "Get into your clothes, you lazy boy. Stop by at Deacon Parsons for a quart of milk. Get to the town pump." soon enough she was addressing him as a lazy good-for-nothing, a lugabed, a worthless limb of Satan. Such words poured out of her absent-mindedly, but never in the old days had she called Johnny such names. The boy least necessary in the shop had always done chores. Now both Dove and Dusty were more valuable than Johnny Tremaine. Every morning he put on the heavy wooden yoke, trudged over to North Square for drinking water. Now, for the first time, he learned to handle a broom properly. He carried in charcoal for the annealing furnace in the shop and wood for the cooking hearth in the kitchen, and as he moved restlessly about doing, and often failing to do, this humble work, Scylla and Izana watched him and said little. Never a single insult. He had made it clear to them he wanted to be left alone. Madge and Dorcas found innumerable small tasks for him. Now he wasn't doing anything. Once Fat Madge made him sit before her holding a skein of yarn from which she wound a ball. He was miserable with his crippled hands stretched out for all the world to see. When she mentioned it, he threw the yarn at her head and walked off. One day, Mr. Lapham called to him and led him to a bench under the old willow behind the coal house. The old man had never once berated him for Sabbath breaking, never reminded him how often he had pointed out that the pride goeth before a fall. "My boy," he said mildly, "soon it will be September. Summer is over." Johnny nodded. "And I feel I must talk with you. When I signed for you, Johnny, there was a mutual contract between your mother and myself. She's dead, so the contract's now between you and me. I promised to feed and clothe you, keep you in good discipline, and as far as your capacity permitted, to teach you the silversmith's arts and mysteries. I never had a boy so quick to teach, but... And you promised to serve me diligently for 7 years to keep my secrets and my honor. You've done all that, Johnny. But now I can't keep my contract with you. I can't teach a cripple-handed boy to be a silversmith." Johnny said nothing. "Mrs. L. is right," the old man went on. "You mean she wants you to get rid of me?" "Not exactly, but she does think it is an extravagance for a poor household to keep a boy just for chores. But I've told her..." There was an unexpected glint of determination in the groping old eyes. "I've told her as long as you wish you are to stay with us. I won't ever turn you out. I mind the time your mother came to my shop with you. She was a sweet lady, very genteel. She said your heart was fastened on being a silversmith. She said you was a bright boy. You always was that. Now, Johnny, it's for your own good I'm talking to you. You've got to learn another way of supporting yourself. I want you to go around, look about the shops, and find out a respectable trade where a bad hand won't matter too much. You're a bright boy, Johnny. Maybe a rope maker or a cooper or a weaver could teach you his craft. That hand of yours will soon be strong enough, but will always be sort of doubled in on itself." Johnny started to look at his hand, but quickly thrust it back in his pocket. "You're right," he said. "I've got to go. I don't want you to feel hurried about leaving us, Johnny. You're just about earning your keep by the odd jobs you do, in spite of what Mrs. L. says. You look about you quietly and find a trade to your fancy and a master you think you'd like. You can tell him from me I'll give the rest of your time away for nothing." It was less than 2 months ago Mr. Revere was promising something extra for his time. "Mrs. L. doesn't like it the way you loiter off and go swimming, but you loiter and swim all you have a mind, just so you get the chores done and settle down real hard to finding yourself a new trade. And one more thing I have on my mind." "Yes, sir." "I want you to forgive Dove like a Christian."
"Forgive him? Why?"
"Why, that when you asked for a crucible, he handed you the old cracked one."
"You mean he did it on purpose?"
No, Johnny, he only meant to humiliate you. He tells me
Mrs. L. made me question him, that he was offended by your Sabbath breaking, and he thought it fitting that you should learn a lesson. I can't help but admit I'm encouraged with that much piety in one of my boys.
Johnny's voice sounded strangled.
Mr. Lapham, I'm gonna get him for that.
Hush, hush, boy. I say, and Bible says, forgive. He was real repentant when he told me. Never meant to harm you. He was in tears.
He's gonna be in a lot more of those tears before I'm done with him. That scabby white louse, that hypocritical...
Hold your tongue, boy. I thought Miss Fortune had taught you patience.
It has, said Johnny. If I have to, I'll wait 10 years to get that dove. But he quieted himself instantly and thanked his master for his kindness. As he walked past the shop, he saw Dove and Dusty hanging idly out of the shop window. They were looking for him. Dove said,
Will Mr. Johnny Tremaine be so kind as to fetch us drinking water?
Mrs. Lapham says we are too valuable to leave our benches. She told us we were to send you. Without a word, he went to the back entry, put on the heavy yoke. Understandably, the sight of Johnny wielding a broom, carrying charcoal, firewood, water, had not quickly lost its fascination for his erstwhile slaves. They were still hanging out of the window.
Look sharp, Johnny.
Hey, boy, look sharp.
Giggles, a low whistle.
Johnny said nothing. Chapter 3. An Earth of Brass. Weeks wore on. September was ending. A large part of every day Johnny spent doing what he called looking for work. He did not really want to follow any trade but his own. He looked down on soap boilers, leather dressers, rope makers, and such. He did not begin his hunt along Hancock's Wharf and Fish Street, where he and his story were well known and the masters would have been apt to employ him from pity. He went to the far ends of Boston. Mr. Lapham had told him to stand about and watch the different artisans at their trades until he was sure it was work he could do. Then he was to address the master politely, explain about his bad hand, and ask to be taken on. But Johnny was too impatient, too unthinking, and too scornful. He barged into shop after shop along the great wharves, and up and down Cornhill and Orange, Ann and Ship Street, Stock Square, King and Queen Streets. Did the master want another boy? Keeping his hand hidden in his pocket. His quickness and address struck everyone favorably, and so an old clockmaker eagerly agreed to take him on, especially when he told them that he had already served Mr. Lapham 2 years.
But why, my boy, is Mr. Lapham ready to part with you now that you must be of value to him?
I've a bad hand.
Let me see it.
He did not want to show his hand, but the masters always insisted. He would take it out of the pocket where he always kept it with a flourish, display it to the sickening curiosity of the master, apprentices, journeymen, lady customers. After such an experience, he would sometimes loiter and swim for the rest of the day. Sometimes he would grit his teeth and plunge headlong into the next shop. He rarely bothered to look at the signs over the door which indicated what work was done inside. A pair of scissors for a tailor, a gold lamb for a wool weaver, a basin for a barber, a painted wooden book for a bookbinder, a large swinging compass for an instrument maker. Although more and more people were learning how to read, the artisans still had signs above their shops, not wishing to lose a possible patron merely because he happened to be illiterate. Having been told by one clockmaker he would not suit, Johnny walked in on two more and got the same answer. A butcher, his sign was a gilded ox skull, would have employed him, but the idea of slaughtering animals sickened him. He was a fine craftsman to the tips of his fingers, even to the tips of his maimed hand. Now he never came home for the hearty midday dinner. Mrs. Lapham, Madge, and Dorcas were always pointing out how much he ate and how little he did. He knew Mrs. Lapham was looking around for a grown-up silversmith who would come in as a partner for Grandpa, and she had said, looking straight at Johnny, she would not ask him to sleep in the attic with the two boys. He was to have the birth and death room.
"I declare," she said one day, "no business can be run with just a feeble old man and three of the most worthless boys in Boston eating their heads off."
Seems she was negotiating with a Mr. Tweedy,
newly arrived from Baltimore. He had arrived alone, but she must make sure he really was a bachelor or a widower. Obviously, whatever partner she found for her father-in-law must marry one of her poor, fatherless girls. The shop must stay in the family. So Johnny ate as little as he could and did not come home at noon. But someone would usually slip a piece of hard bread, cheese, jerked beef or salt fish and Johnny cake in the pocket of his jacket as it hung on its hook. He knew it was Scylla, but he never spoke to her about it. His unhappiness was so great he felt himself completely cut off from the rest of the world. But sometimes, as he lay in the sun on Beacon Hill or Copse Hill among the graves, or curled himself upon a coil of rope along a wharf, eating the food she had managed to get for him, he would dream of the great things he would do for her when he was man-grown. There were three things she longed for: a gold necklace, a gray pony with a basket cart, a little sailboat. He dreamed of himself as successful, rich, never as the ditch-digger and rag-picker Mrs. Lapham was always suggesting to him. Some days there was no food in his pocket. Then he went hungry. On one such day he was strolling up Salt Lane. Here about him and on Union Street were printing offices. It was noon, and all over Boston work had stopped, and everyone, except himself, had either gone home for dinner or to one of the famous taverns. Above one tiny shop he saw a sign that attracted him. It was a little man in a bright blue coat and red breeches, solemnly gazing at Salt Lane through a spyglass. So this was where the Boston Observer was published. The Laphams took no newspaper, but he had heard Mr. Lapham speak of the wicked Observer and how it was trying to stir up discontent in Boston, urging the people to revolt against the mild rule of England. The comical little painted man looked so genial, so ready to welcome anyone, that Johnny stepped in. He might have guessed he would waste his time. Of course the master would be off for dinner, but because he had liked the painted sign, he went in. He had not even stopped to consider whether or not apprentice work was something that he could do. He saw the squat, bug-like printing press, the trays of type, the strings on which printed sheets were hung to dry like clothes on a line. On a workbench was a smaller press for notifications, proclamations, broadsides, trade cards. Everything smelled of printer's ink. A boy, larger than himself and probably a few years older, was standing at a counter talking with a stout market woman in a frayed red skirt. Her pig had strayed from her yard. She wished to advertise it. The boy wrote down what she said. "Lost a spotted sow from White Bread Alley," the boy repeated. "She was the dearest pig," said the woman. "Would come for a whistle like a dog. My children taught her to play dead pig. We don't ever think to eat her, only her increase. We called her Myra." The boy did not write that down. He lifted his dark face, indolent dark eyes. The lashes flickered. He was interested. "Was she hard to teach, ma'am?" "Oh, no. Pigs are clever." "I never knew that. How do they compare with dogs?" Then the old lady began to talk. She talked about pigs in general and her Myra in particular. The printer's boy, unruffled, unhurried, heard her through. He was tall and powerfully built. There was something a little sluggish in his casual movements, in his voice, almost as though he was saving himself for emergencies, not wasting himself on every casual encounter. The woman was delighted with so good a listener and his few intelligent questions. Johnny, standing at the door, forgot his own errand. He had no idea that either pigs or old market women could be so interesting. It was the apprentice, standing at the counter in his leather apron and full white shirt, his thoughtful face framed in hair, black and straight as an Indian's, who had cast a spell over the old gossip and her subject. Although the boy had nodded casually as Johnny came in, he did not speak to him until after the woman was gone and he had set up the few lines of type. There was nothing rude about this seeming neglect. It was almost as if they were friends of long standing. The strange boy had none of the bustling smartness of the usual Boston apprentice. Johnny had seen enough of them in the last month, apprentices who knew what you wanted and that you would not suit, and you were out on the street again in 3 minutes. Having set the advertisement, the boy took a covered basket from under the counter, put it on a table, and drew up two stools. "Why don't you sit down?" he said. "And eat. My master's wife, she's my aunt, always sends over more than I can manage." Seemingly, he had sized up everything with only half a glance from the lazy dark eyes. He had known Johnny was hungry without once really looking at him, and had also known that he was someone he himself liked. He was both friendly and aloof. Nonchalantly, he took out his clasp knife, cut hunks of bread from the long loaf. There were also cheese, apples, and ham. The ham seemed to remind the printer's boy of the gossip and her pig. "I grew up on a farm," he said, "but I never knew you could teach a pig tricks. Help yourself to more bread?" Johnny hesitated. So far, he had not taken his bad hand out of his pocket since entering the shop. Now he must, or go hungry. He took the clasp knife in his left hand and stealthily drew forth the maimed hand to steady the loaf. It was hard to saw through the crusty loaf with a left hand, but he managed to do it. It took a long time. The other boy said nothing. He did not, thank God, offer to help him. Of course he had seen the crippled hand, but at least he did not stare at it. Asked no questions. Seemingly he saw everything and said nothing. "Because of this quality in him," Johnny said. "I'm looking for some sort of work I think I could do well in, even with a bad hand." "That's quite a recent burn." It was the first intelligent remark any man, woman, or child had made about Johnny's hand in any shop he had been in. "I did it last July. I was apprenticed to a silversmith. I burned it on hot silver." "I see. So everything you are trained for is out?" "Yes. I wouldn't mind so much being a clockmaker or an instrument maker, but I can't. And I won't be a butcher or a soap boiler. No. I've got to do something I like, or... The dark boy put the question to him he had not been able to ask himself. "Or what?" Johnny lifted his thin, fair face. His lips parted before he spoke. I just don't know. I can't think." Apparently, the printer's boy did not know either. All he said was, "More cheese?" Then Johnny began to talk. He told all about the Laphams and how he somehow couldn't even seem to thank Scylla for the food she usually got to him. How cross and irritable he had become. How rude to people who told him they were sorry for him. And he admitted he had used no sense in looking for a new job. He told about the burn, but with none of the belligerent arrogance with which he had been answering the questions kind people had put to him. As he talked to Rab, for the boy had told him this was his name, for the first time since the accident, he felt able to stand aside from his problems, see himself. Mr. Lorne, Rab's uncle by marriage, came back. He was a scholarly young man with a face as sharp and bright as a fox's. Rab did not immediately spring into action to make a good show of his industry before his master. He had none of the usual, "Yes, sir, no, sir, please, sir." He went on calmly eating bread and cheese. On Mr. Lorne's heels came two little boys in big aprons, the Webb twins. Seemingly, they went back to their master's house across Salt Lane for dinner, while the nephew ate out of a basket and minded the shop. The Webbs were set to work. Mr. Lorne began to ink a pad. Johnny felt he must go. Rab walked with him to the door. He was still eating bread and cheese. "I don't know how you'll make out," said Rab. "Of course you can get work, if you'll take it." "I know. Unskilled work." "Yes, work you don't want." "But..." The dinner had raised Johnny's hopes. "I feel sure I'll get something." Overhead, the little man with the spyglass and the red breeches was swinging in the wind, observing Boston from a variety of angles. Rab said, "There is some work here you could do. Not the sort that teaches a boy a skilled trade. Just riding for us, delivering papers all over Boston and around. Nothing you'd want, but if you can't find anything else, you come back."
I'll come back, all right. But not until I can tell you what a good job I found myself.
You haven't any folks?
None at all.
I've got lots of relatives, said Rab, but my parents are dead.
Oh.
Come again.
I'll come.
It wasn't the food alone that so raised Johnny's hopes. It was Rab himself, and ease and confidence flowed out and supported those around him. The market woman had felt better about losing her Myra after she talked with Rab. He was the first person to whom Johnny Tremaine had confided his own story.
2. The coming of Mr. Percival Tweedy, journeyman silversmith of Baltimore, cast a longer and longer shadow over the Lapham household and conversation. While the terms of partnership were being drawn up, he stayed at a cheap lodging house on Fish Street. Johnny left right after breakfast and often did not return until dark. He did not meet Mr. Tweedy for a long time, and he got tired of hearing about him. Mr. Tweedy was ready to sign the contract of partnership Mrs. Lapham had had drawn up, and Mr. Tweedy would not sign. When Mr. Tweedy came to the shop, it was Dorcas he seemed to fancy. No, it was Madge. Although almost 40, he was still a bachelor. Mrs. Lapham had asked him about that. Johnny already hated the very sound of his name, and then one morning, before breakfast, he met him. Mr. Tweedy was diffidently standing about in the shop, hoping Mrs. Lapham would ask him to breakfast. He was fingering a pocketbook sent in for a new clasp, and his stomach was rolling from hunger.
"Hey," said Johnny rudely.
The timid creature jumped like a shot rabbit and dropped the pocketbook.
"What are you doing here?"
the boy demanded, pretending he had caught a thief. Mr. Tweedy swallowed twice, his Adam's apple rising and falling with emotion, but said nothing.
"Are you a thief, or are you that Tweedy man I've heard tell of?"
"I'm Tweedy."
"I'm Johnny Tremaine."
"You don't say."
"I'll tell Mrs. Lapham you're here for breakfast."
I just happened by, just thought I'd come in."
He had a queer, squeaky voice. Johnny disliked him even more than he had expected. Such impotence, such timidity in a grown man irritated the boy.
"Oh, come out with it, Flat," he said. "You've been getting your dinners here free for 2 weeks, and now you're feeling out for breakfast."
"I don't care, not me. But I'll warn the women to put on an extra plate."
The man said nothing, but he looked at Johnny, and the look of bleak hatred amazed the boy. He had not guessed Mr. Tweedy had that much gumption in him. Mrs. Lapham came thumping down the stairs. It was her second trip to the foot of the attic ladder, and still she wasn't sure Dove and Dusty were out of bed. Everything had gone wrong. Breakfast was late. Madge had a felon on her finger and wasn't good for anything, and Dorcas was complaining because there was no butter for breakfast. She had slapped Dorcas, who had gone out back to cry. How easily, smoothly, everything had gone on in the old days before Johnny got hurt. Then the household went like clockwork, and the shop had earned money for butter and butcher's meat once or twice a week. The sight of Johnny Tremaine standing there in the lower hall doing nothing, good for nothing, irritated her.
"Hurry,"
she snorted and waddled into the kitchen, Johnny on her heels. The fire was smoking, and she knelt down to mend it. Johnny might have done that while she was upstairs. Although Johnny was now looked upon as something of a black sheep and Mrs. Lapham was no longer telling him he would end up picking rags, but on the gallows, he thought it behooved him to tell her just what he thought of Mr. Tweedy.
"I can see why that Tweedy has never been a master smith. He hasn't the force of character. As a man, he's no good, if he is a man, which I doubt. I think he's somebody's spinster aunt dressed up in men's clothes."
Mrs. Lapham heaved herself to her knees and brushed back her streaming hair with a red forearm.
"You don't say!"
Her voice showed her exasperation. She had found Mr. Tweedy herself. She was trying to nurse him along to get the wary creature to sign her contract and marry one of her girls.
"Yep, I do say," said Johnny. "I've just been talking with him. He's no good, and he...
He's here now?"
"Yep. In the shop. That squeak pig is trying to horn in on breakfast."
The doors were all open. Anyone in the shop could have heard Johnny's insults. Slowly, like a great sow pulling out of a wallow, Mrs. Lapham got to her feet, glaring down at Johnny, her enormous bosom heaving. "And I'm going to tell you what I think of that squeak pig." Without a word, and before he could finish his remarks or dodge, Mrs. Lapham gave him a resounding cuff on the ear. "Sometimes actions do speak louder than words," she said. "And this is one of them times. You get right out of here, Johnny Tremaine. That tongue of yours isn't going to do any more damage in my house." 3. Johnny grabbed his jacket. Scylla had not yet put food in it. Pulled his tattered hat over his eyes and stalked out. Since his accident, he had unconsciously taken to wearing his hat at a rakish angle. This, and the way he always kept his right hand thrust into his breeches pocket, gave him a slightly arrogant air. The arrogance had always been there, but formerly it had come out in pride in his work, not in the way he wore his hat and walked. He told no one what he did all day, and Mrs. Lapham was convinced that he had taken to, or was about to take to, evil ways. He did look, at times, both shabby and desperate. In other words, a potential criminal. Sometimes he looked so proud and fine, people thought he must be a great gentleman's son in misfortune. One thing he did not look like any more was a smart, industrious Boston apprentice. He walked down Fish Street to Anne, crossed Dock Square with Faneuil Hall on his left. It was market day. He picked his way about the farm carts, the piles of whitish-green cabbages, baskets of yellow corn, rows of plump, pale, plucked turkeys, orange pumpkins, country cheeses, big as a baby's head. Some of the market folk, men and women, children and black slaves, called to him, seeing in the shabby proud boy a possible rich customer, but others counted the pats of butter on their tables after he had passed by. Without heeding anyone, he crossed Dock Square, and in a moment's time stood beside the brick townhouse at the head of King Street. The lower floor of the townhouse was an open promenade, and every day the merchants gathered on change. Not a merchant in sight. They did not rise as early as market folk. Suddenly Johnny had an idea. Although seemingly he had tried every shop in Boston in search of a new master, he had not tried the merchants. From where he sat on the steps of the townhouse, he could look the brief length of King Street, which quickly and imperceptibly turned into Long Wharf, running for half a mile into the sea. It was the only wharf in Boston larger than Hancock's. There was not another wharf in all America so large, so famous, so rich. As at his own wharf, one side was built up solidly with counting houses, warehouses, sail lofts, and stores. The other side was left open for ships. Already sailors, porters, riggers, and such were at work. He waited, it seemed to him, for a long time, and then the clerks began to arrive. Counting house doors were unlocked, warehouses were unchained. At last the merchants came, some striding down King Street, rosy-faced, double-chinned, known and greeted by everyone, apparently knowing and greeting everyone in return. Some came in chaises, gigs. Some had sour, gimlet-eyed faces. Some had not yet lost the rolling gait of sea captains. Johnny saw the same gray horse and gig, with the arms upon the door that had carried John Hancock to the Laphams last July, trot quickly down King Street and onto Long Wharf. Although Mr. Hancock had recently bought Hancock's wharf, his principal place of business was on Long. Mr. Hancock has on a cherry-red coat, Johnny thought. He drives the horse himself, but now he is getting out, telling that dressed-up doll of a black boy to put his horse up for him. Johnny decided he would start at the top of the merchants and work down, only, of course, skipping merchant light. He'd go first to John Hancock. From where he sat, he could see that a great ship was slowly warping in. No coaster, this. No mere sugar boat from the Sugar Isles. A number of fashionably dressed young men, as well as the usual dockhands and porters, were crowding about to welcome her. There was the heavy clatter of a great coach almost beside him, and the coachman was bawling to lesser folk, "Make way! Make way!" black horses in glittering silver-mounted harnesses, the rumble and rattle of a ruby coach on cobbles, and on the door panel the familiar crest, a rising eye. Half seen inside, Merchant Jonathan Light. Evidently he had just heard his ship was in and had come down from his mansion on Beacon Hill in a hurry. He was still struggling with the lace about his throat. Johnny left his seat and strolled down the wharf to watch. No one had ever told him not to watch the lights, but he always felt guilty when he did. From afar, he knew them all. He knew, for instance, that Mr. Light had a broken front tooth. He knew Mrs. Light was dead and two sons had been drowned as boys, and girls had died in infancy. This he could read upon the slate gravestones of Copp's Hill. He knew that besides the townhouse on Beacon Hill, there was a country seat at Milton. And he knew that Lavinia Light had spent the last summer in London. Now she was back in Boston once more. She was very tall for a woman, slender and graceful, and moved slowly down the gangplank with the stately self-consciousness which happened to be the fashionable gait for a lady at the moment. 100 times before, Johnny had stopped on the streets of Boston or before her house to watch her. He but one more gaping face in a crowd, she the accepted reigning belle. He admired her odd, strong beauty, which, unlike her regal gait, was not of the fashionable type. To begin with, she was too tall, and golden curls, pink and white skin, were the mode. She was a black-haired woman, and only for balls and such she was powdered and curled. In contrast, her skin was dead white. Her features were clear-cut enough to justify the poems written to her in London and even here in Boston, comparing her to a classic goddess. There was only one flaw to her marble beauty. Between the low, sweeping black brows was a tiny, perpendicular line. Once, and once only, the master hand that carved her face had let the chisel slip. This blemish was odd enough for a young lady still in her 20s. It boded no good for the peace of mind of those about her, nor for her own. Now she was all glitter and smiles, greeting the young gentleman who had come to meet her. Johnny did not notice what she wore, but the mantua makers, dressmakers, milliners, glovers, and jewelers all knew that whatever Lavinia Light brought back from London would set Boston styles for the winter. "Oh, Papa, Papa!" she suddenly exclaimed. There was an urgency in her voice, a soft flash in her eyes none of the young men's faces had called forth. Like any country girl, merely glad to be home again, she flung herself into her father's arms. Spiritually, Johnny shrugged, determined to be neither over-impressed nor envious. That overdressed moppet. That lean beanpole. For Miss Lavinia was lean in comparison to Madge and Dorcas, who had always been held up to Johnny as the end-all of feminine beauty. Bad-tempered, too. I hope she kills herself overeating cakes and plum pudding, turkeys with stuffing and gravy, hot white rolls. His stomach was gnawing at him. He forgot Lavinia Light as he thought of the wonderful things it was her privilege to overeat if she wished. Surely by now enough time had passed since John Hancock's arrival at his counting house so that he would be ready to talk to a likely boy looking for work. His hand might be good enough for a cabin boy. Johnny found one does not step into a great merchant's counting house and see the merchant as easily as one steps into a shop and sees the master artisan. Although he had made up his mind that he would begin his conversation with Mr. Hancock by explaining he had a burned hand, he did not see any reason why he should explain to the clerk who stopped him in the outer office. All he said was that he wanted work. The clerk asked him if he could read and write. He said he could. The thin, weak-eyed gentleman gave him a mortgage and told him to read that. This he read well. Then Mr. Hancock, who had been sitting alone over his little hearth fire in the back office, came out. He had been attracted by the quality of the boy's voice, for although Johnny often spoke in the rougher, slurring manner of Hancock's wharf, in reading he reverted to the cleaner speech his mother had taught him. Mr. Hancock did not recognize him as the apprentice of Mr. Lapham, who had rashly promised a sugar basin in time for his Aunt Lydia's birthday. And then the old man had been forced at the last minute to admit he could not do it.
"Add this, my lad," he said, handing Johnny an invoice he held in his hand. Johnny added easily. He was given a few more simple sums, which he did in his head. The clerk and merchant exchanged glances. Mr. Hancock said, "If your handwriting is as good as your reading and ciphering, I promise you a place right here in my counting house. I've been put to it to find just the right boy. Your writing..." "I've been taught to write." But Johnny was suddenly frightened. The clerk put a piece of paper before him and inked a pen. "Write John Hancock, Esquire." Johnny stubbornly stared at the paper. At last he had found a place where he wanted to be, and he knew that ever and again boys who started working for great merchants became great merchants themselves. Surely, surely, if only he tried hard enough he could do it. He could write for the length of just John Hancock, Esquire. His hand shot out of his pocket, grasped the pen. The letters were as clumsy as though written with a left hand. The clerk laughed. "Mr. Hancock, I've never seen worse writing." The merchant said, "My boy, you must have been rattled. Surely you can do better than that." Johnny stared at his miserable scratches. "God help me," he whispered. "It's the best I can do." "Why, the lad has a crippled hand. Look, Mr. Hancock." Mr. Hancock quickly averted his fine eyes. "Run away, boy, run away. You knew you could not do the work, and yet you came and took up my valuable time, and... But I thought maybe you could ship me as a cabin boy. And carry the captain's grog? And be brisk and useful to him? No, no. My captains want whole boys. So now, go away, please." Johnny wandered off. "I burned my hand making you a silver basin. Now it's... Go away, please." He flung himself down in the shadow of a sail loft, for the late September day was warm as summer. He could hear the tap of shipwrights' hammers, the creak of wooden wheels, a boatswain's whistle. Everywhere boys and men were at work. Only he was idle. He saw, picking his way delicately around barrels of molasses, bales, ox teams, a familiar, fantastic figure. It was Mr. Hancock's little black slave, Jehu. He was looking from side to side. When he saw Johnny, he went to him and said like a parrot, "My master, Mr. John Hancock, Esquire, has commanded me to give this purse to the poor work boy in the broken shoes who just left his counting house, and to tell him that he wishes him well." Johnny took the purse. It was heavy. That much copper would provide him with food for days. He opened it. It was not copper, but silver. John Hancock had not been able to look at the crippled hand, nor could he help but make this handsome present. 4. The thought of Lavinia Light gorging herself to death, if it pleased her, on fine foods had started the gastric juices in his stomach an hour ago. He had had no breakfast, and for supper the night before, only one salt alewife and a mug of milk. It was noontime, and he craved food. Not the mere coarse bread, cheese, ale, and apples which had always made up the large part of his diet, but rare and interesting things such as he had smelled cooking in rich people's houses and the best taverns, but had never tasted. First he tormented his hunger by going from one tavern kitchen to the next to see which smelled the best. At the Bunch of Grapes, a maid was basting a roast of beef. A spicy pudding was bubbling on the hearth. At the King's Coffee House, a suckling pig was so crisp and brown it was fairly bursting. He almost drooled at this pig, but he walked on. And everywhere he smelled chocolate and coffee. He had never in his life tasted either. He stopped in the kitchen of the Afric Queen. What he saw there made him feel he had swallowed a small live kitten, but he could almost enjoy these pangs, for in his pocket was Mr. Hancock's silver. Any minute he could assuage that kitten. And so to the Cromwell Head and back again to Union Street. His mind was made up. He would dine at the Afric Queen. For here he had seen maids roasting innumerable small squabs, each stuffed with fragrant dressing and wrapped in bacon,
and he had seen pastries. Apple, mince, pumpkin, plum tarts coming out of the brick